from WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence. I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Osama bin Laden is back, it seems, in an ominous audio tape released yesterday to the world. Rise up and fight these despots who seek to bring war to Iraq, said the now familiar voice. And Washington revved up the war push another notch, saying the bin Laden statement was proof of an alliance between al-Qaeda and Baghdad. If this is not an unholy partnership, I have not heard of one, said White House spokesman Ari Fleischer. Tonight on Point, the bin Laden call to arms, what it means for terrorism at home and war abroad. We begin tonight with terror alerts in London. Both the U.S. and the U.K. have been put on high alert amid warnings that a major terrorist attack is feared soon. The U.S. Air Force stepped up combat air patrols over Washington today. In London, 1,500 police officers, armed troops, and tanks were deployed to patrol Heathrow Airport. Richard Beeston is diplomatic editor for the Times of London. I asked him to describe the situation in the U.K. right now.
Well, it may seem old hat for people who've been traveling in America for the last year and a half, but you have to remember this is a country where even an armed policeman still raises an eyebrow. So you can imagine passengers have been very shocked to see tanks at Heathrow Airport, heavily armed police. The authorities have been cagey about exactly what the nature of the threat is, but it seems very clear that they fear that terrorists are planning an attack against an airliner, possibly a repeat of what happened against an Israeli airliner in Mombasa last year when al-Qaeda terrorists fired two surface-to-air missiles. And I think that seems to be the threat that they consider at the moment.
Your Home Secretary said today that they had even considered closing Heathrow. How close did they come to doing that?
It's hard to judge. I think it would have been such a momentous thing. Of course, Heathrow is not only serves London, but it's the international hub for most of the transatlantic flights and stuff. So I think they would have to be incredibly sure that attack was imminent. And there's still a strong sense here that once you start taking that type of measures, closing down your big institutions and facilities, that you're really playing into the hands of the terrorists. So it was certainly one of the aspects considered. And I know that there was a meeting on Monday of the Intelligence Committee and it was discussed at cabinet level. They decided not to take that action, but obviously deploying hundreds of troops is the next step.
The Labour Party chairman John Reid said earlier that there's a terrorist threat to London now on a scale of the September 11th attacks on New York. What's the background to this kind of very large threat description?
Well, I think it's twofold, really. One thing to bear in mind is that Britain has taken a very strong position alongside the United States in Afghanistan, now in Iraq, and I think, you know, by any measure has been strongly identified with the U.S. But we haven't suffered any sizable terrorist attack against us since September the 11th. There were some British holidaymakers who were killed in the Bali bombing last year. But apart from that, we haven't been hit. The Israelis have been hit. The Australians were hit. American forces have been targeted and American officials around the world. So I think the expectation is that we are definitely in the sights, if you like. We took a big part in the operation of Afghanistan. So we're definitely on the list. Secondly, of course, this is a very international city, London. There are numerous people from all over the world here. Frankly, our security could be better, in my opinion. There are lots of asylum seekers who've been slipping into the country, and they're hundreds unchecked. We don't know. Many of them from Iraq, incidentally. Nobody knows who they are, where they've come from, really. So I think there is a fear that if bin Laden had wanted to do something against Britain, this would be an ideal place to have his sleepers. There's a large Muslim community here. There are many sympathizers here. It's a definite a potential source. Throw into that the fact that they've been getting tip-offs, obviously, from the intelligence services, and I think that explains really why you have this panic on at the moment.
And yet, after Labour Chairman John Reid made the comparison, the statement citing September 11th, there was some suggestion that he might be trying to play a kind of public relations game to whip up a state of siege mentality that would pull people into line behind the war effort in Iraq. He responded very angrily to that. Why that kind of skepticism?
Well, I suppose the timing is regarded as almost too convenient, and people are suspicious. The government here is having a difficult time making the case to the British public that the war in Iraq is important, and particularly difficult is making that link between Saddam Hussein and his weapons of mass destruction and the war on terror and the threat posed by al-Qaeda. And I know that that argument's been going on in America as well, but opinion polls in America show that far more Americans support President Bush in his preparations for action in Iraq. Tony Blair doesn't have that sort of support here. So you can imagine that there are skeptics here who think the government will resort to anything, really, to try and get the public behind them, including mobilizing troops and whatnot to the airport and talking up the terrorist threat. Personally, I think it's pretty far-fetched. I don't think they would go to these extreme measures just for a public relations exercise. You know, that large numbers of security forces are involved in this. I think it would have to be a serious threat to get the police, the army, and the intelligence services involved at this level.
Richard Beeston, there was a lot of attention paid in the States yesterday to Osama bin Laden's latest statement over Al Jazeera. Is that getting airtime and attention in the UK as well? How's it being received, interpreted?
Yes, I think it's getting a lot of attention here. We certainly are the main story on our front page this morning and most of the other British newspapers. I think it was seen as an important event for two reasons, really. One, obviously, even if Iraq is playing down any connection it might have with al-Qaeda, the link has now been made by bin Laden himself. And I think it also shows that bin Laden is a man who's prepared to latch on to any popular cause in an effort to win support for his group, and he's never had any ideological support for Iraq and its regime, but obviously he thinks this is something he can cash in on, and so he's jumping in with both feet. But I think it does make the government's case easier here to say, well, you know, you can see now what we're up against. This man is urging his supporters to go and fight on behalf of Iraq, and obviously it assists the government in making that case in the public's mind.
And is the public buying that link? There's been some skepticism about that very point here in the United States.
No, the case hasn't really been made properly yet, I don't think, and the public is still deeply skeptical about it. Much, I think, will depend on Hans Blix's report back to the United Nations Security Council on Friday. Many people here, I think, would be prepared to go along with action if it was supported by a second resolution, and obviously that will depend on his assessment of how Iraq is complying or not. I think the government here is committed pretty well willy-nilly to go ahead with the war, even if it means just going with the Americans and the Australians and the few other countries who are prepared to go. But it will be an enormous political gamble for Tony Blair, the biggest of his career. And if the war went wrong, or if lots of people were killed, either civilians or British troops or whatever, that could be the end of him.
We'll all be watching. Richard Beeston, thank you for joining us.
You're very welcome.
Richard Beeston is diplomatic editor for the Times of London. He spoke with us earlier from London. We're talking tonight about the latest message from he who was not named in the State of the Union address, but is on everyone's mind tonight. When Osama bin Laden speaks, terror often follows. Washington and London are clearly on pins and needles right now, braced for another potential attack. But the latest bin Laden tape is focused on an impending American attack on Baghdad, with tips for Iraqi resistance and assurances that the Crusaders can be defeated. Washington describes it as proof of an al-Qaeda-Baghdad alliance. And we will look at that claim tonight. But there is a bigger game afoot here, a play for hearts and minds in the Middle East, and for fear and foreboding in President Bush's coalition of the willing. Who is winning that struggle tonight? Does bin Laden sound on the run to you? Does he sound like he welcomes war? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me tonight from Singapore is Rohan Gunaratna, author of Inside Al-Qaeda, Global Network of Terror, and one of the world's leading authorities on Al-Qaeda. Good evening and welcome, Rohan Gunaratna.
Good evening to you.
Thanks for being with us. And with me in the studio tonight is On Point news analyst Jack Beattie, senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly. Jack, good to have you here.
Thank you. Welcome.
Rohan Gunaratna, thank you for joining us at this early hour in Singapore. You must be one of the best informed of listeners to Osama bin Laden's most recent message, a statement that came out over Al Jazeera. What What struck you as the highlights here? What's the big message? What's bin Laden attempting here?
Osama is planning to instigate and inspire the Muslim community towards supporting him and supporting his organization in the fight against the United States. And he's using the Iraqi issue very effectively.
We know, we've seen again and again, that he's good with words, and we're told with words in a way that's particularly effective in an Islamic context, in an Arab context. Can you describe for us, in your view, Rohan Gunaratne, how this message is likely to fall on Middle Eastern ears, and in particular on Iraqi ears? He addresses Iraqis directly.
Yes. In fact, what he's doing is he's politicizing and radicalizing the Muslims and mobilizing them in a direction that would make it difficult for the United States to justify its intervention in Iraq. And at the same time, he's espousing the Iraqi issue as one of the key issues. Osama has now shifted three times. First, by saying that the United States has no justification for presence of troops in Saudi Arabia into the Palestinian issue, and now he's taking on the Iraqi issue.
And in between, there was the Palestinians, who he briefly embraced.
Absolutely. So you can see that he is a leader who will take up any issue that he's able to use to galvanize public Muslim support for the purpose of waging this global jihad with the United States as the number one enemy.
So if he's attempting to politicize and radicalize Muslims, is it working? Is it working in the Middle East, and is it working in Iraq? Do Iraqis even hear these messages?
To some extent, his message has resonance and support among certain marginalized sections of the Muslim population, not only in the Middle East and in the Asian Muslim world, mm-hmm. but also among the Muslim migrant communities in North America and Western Europe.
Do Iraqis hear this? Just at a practical level, was it broadcast in Iraq? It's hard to imagine exactly Saddam Hussein welcoming it. Did Iraqis hear this statement? Did they physically hear it?
Yes, certainly. Iraqis have heard it. Not only that, there is a narrow section of the Iraqis who are Islamists. And of course, Saddam has traditionally suppressed them. Mm-hmm. And these Iraqis support Osama bin Laden. And we have seen that all his messages have found great appeal and great support among that narrow band of Islamists.
Jack Beattie, there's a lot to sort out here. He, on the one hand, he encourages Iraqis to take up arms against the Americans. He points to Tora Bora and says, we had a victory there. You can have the same. Dig trenches. At the same time, he does not support secular rulers. He calls them infidels. Saddam Hussein would fall in that category. Many facets to this message.
Yes, there are. And we can see the two wars coming together here. He's saying, we are talking about our Iraq war, and he's saying, oh, there's this other war. You're not making war on Saddam, Americans. You are crusaders. He casts us in the metaphor in the Western, of Western, you know, despoiling
mm-hmm.
of the area. We're against the Muslim people, and suddenly he's taking that war that we think is about Saddam, and he says, no, it's really against the Muslim people. And it's a very effective piece of work. And you're right. I mean, the Secretary Powell says it shows he's in partnership with Iraq. But, of course, it's nothing like that at all. In fact, he says the fighting should be in the name of God only, not to seek victory for the ignorant governments that rule all Arab states, including Iraq. This is about God, not about Iraq, and certainly not about Saddam for him.
We want to come back and look at that. But just in a word, Rohan Gunaratne, do you think that Saddam Hussein welcomes this message tactically or not?
Saddam would certainly welcome his message because America is an enemy both to Saddam and to Osama bin Laden. America is the number one enemy of Saddam and of Osama.
Rohan Gunaratne, please stand by. We'll be right back after a short break. We're talking tonight about the new bin Laden message and what it means for terror at home, war abroad, and the battle for hearts and minds in the Middle East and beyond. Bin Laden's back. Are you duct taping your windows and hoarding food? Is it eerie to you? How strategically timed Osama bin Laden's pronouncements seem to be. Join us, 1-800-423-8255. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the new bin Laden message and what it means for terror at home, war abroad, and the battle for hearts and minds in the Middle East. You can join the conversation. Do you buy the Bush administration's assertion that this message proves the Al-Qaeda-Baghdad alliance? Can you imagine how this voice sounds to Middle Eastern ears, to Iraqi ears? And does Osama bin Laden seem to welcome the looming war with Iraq? Is Washington playing into his hands? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We're pleased to be joined tonight from Singapore by Rohan Gunaratne, author of Inside Al-Qaeda, Global Network of Terror, and a leading global authority on Al-Qaeda. We're joined as well right now by Dan Byman, joining us from Washington, D.C. He's assistant professor of security studies at Georgetown University and a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution, author of The Dynamics of Coercion, American Foreign Policy and the Limits of Military Might. Good evening and welcome, Dan Byman.
Thank you.
Dan, what do you make of Colin Powell's and others' assertion yesterday that Osama bin Laden's statement, aired on Al Jazeera and now all over the world, is a firm indication of a link, even an alliance of sorts, between Al-Qaeda and Baghdad?
The key is the word you choose. If you choose alliance, it's far too strong. Al-Qaeda and Iraq may work together as long as their interests coincide. They've cooperated to some degree in terms of training in the past. And they certainly have links, but there's no sense that Saddam is directing Al-Qaeda. There's no sense of control. Rather, it's a small-scale tactical alliance where each feels that the other is helping them serve their ends.
But is it a deliberate alliance? I mean, his statement specifically suggests at some points that Iraq would be better off without Saddam Hussein. So do you imagine a deliberate, orchestrated linkage here, or is this just a confluence of interests that also has contention within it?
Bin Laden was speaking to multiple audiences. He was speaking to one audience trying to urge jihad against the United States, trying to urge attacks against the United States. But he was also trying to tell his followers in the Islamist community that he is remaining true to one of their number one priorities, which is overthrowing secular regimes exactly like Saddam. So Al-Qaeda and Saddam are both pragmatic enough to actually cooperate on specifics, even though they loathe each other. But should the common enemy, in this case the United States, be removed, they will go back to fighting each other.
Rohan Gunaratne, I'm sure you were listening, even there from Singapore, and heard how American officials responded. What do you think of their interpretation? Even before the statement was public, Colin Powell was saying, here we have evidence of this coming together of forces. Is that an accurate interpretation of what we hear in this message, Rohan Gunaratne?
I think the American officials will want to say it is an alliance. I believe it is more a convergence of interests. I examined several thousands of documents that came out of Afghanistan after October 2001. I could not find a single document that linked Saddam with Osama or Al-Qaeda with the Baghdad regime. However, we have seen that both Saddam regime and Al-Qaeda has persistently been opposed to the United States. And at this point of time, we are seeing that these two entities will steadfastly work against the United States.
So in your mind, if it's not an alliance, but a convergence of interests, Rohan Gunaratne, is that a distinction without a difference from an American strategic or tactical point of view? Does it matter whether they love each other or they just have a convergence of interests? Does it justify the depiction of these as a twinned pair of threats?
Yes, certainly. You used the correct word. It's a twinned pair of threats. And I believe that the American government should make a careful assessment whether this is the right time to confront Iraq, especially because of the intelligence reports we have that Al-Qaeda has regrouped and Al-Qaeda is planning to conduct large-scale operations against U.S. targets and the targets of allies and friends of the United States. The terrorist threat is increasing.
Dan Byman, do you see that as well? We certainly see focus bordering on alarm in Washington and London. Why?
Well, the alarm is quite real. Al-Qaeda has been coming, and this is something that officials have warned of since September 11th, that there is another attack is likely. In fact, I think the interesting question in some ways is it's been a year and a half, yet there has not been a major al-Qaeda attack on U.S. soil or that has killed large numbers of Americans.
How do you interpret that fact, that they don't have the capacity or have not had the capacity to deliver, or that they're biding their time?
Largely biding their time. Clearly, their capacity was, I think, severely hurt by both losing Afghanistan and the worldwide effort or semi-worldwide effort against them. Mm-hmm. But al-Qaeda has always shown remarkably a degree of patience, and it's willing to wait for the right moment. That's why, in some ways, the focus on the war with Iraq, I think, is a little misleading, because it implies that if the war is over in a week or 2 weeks, that the threat will die down as well, when al-Qaeda will simply wait for the right moment for its attack and strike accordingly.
Jack Beatty, so much to look at here. We see the photographs tonight coming over the newswire of anti-aircraft missiles around the Washington Monument. It's a chilling kind of image. We hear Rohan Gunaratne saying there's a convergence of interests, if not an alliance, and it amounts to a distinction without a difference, that in fact these are twinned perils at this point. I hear him giving credence to some of what Colin Powell says, even while bin Laden's own words draw a distinction between the Iraqi people and the Iraqi leadership, the kind of distinction Americans are accustomed to making.
Yes, I mean, I defer to him on expertise, but just parsing the words, it looks as if bin Laden is essentially poaching on our war against Saddam, and he's using it, as critics of this war have said from the beginning, as a recruiting device. He's saying, look, the Crusaders are going to come to Baghdad, a holy city in Muslim history. They're going to sack, you know, he's painting what we're doing in terms of the war that he's got against us, which is this holy war. He's just hijacking it as a propaganda vehicle. This doesn't imply any alliance. He's against us, and so is Saddam. But that doesn't mean that these two are working together. And the claims, you know, the claims that we have been making about this, you know, there have been a series of these claims. First, the claims were about the past, that Saddam and al-Qaeda were involved in September, that Saddam was involved in September 11th. Mm. Those went away. Now we have all these claims about the present, including the group in Baghdad that allegedly is part of al-Qaeda. Then you read Europeans saying, no, they don't think it's part of al-Qaeda. But now all of these claims, I think, and some of them seeming to be distortions, are to hide something else. We're making this war against a fear, against a future possibility. Not that there's been a past one, not that Saddam has given weapons to these people, or not that he's doing it now, but that he might. We're about to launch the first aggressive war in our history on the basis of a fear, a possibility.
Dan Byman, let me turn first to you. War on Iraq, does it help or hurt our war on terrorism?
Well, there's certainly competition. I mean, there are a couple issues. One is, as was alluded to just now, Osama bin Laden and terrorist groups in general try to grab the spotlight. Mm-hmm. And they will certainly use this to increase recruitment, to increase fundraising, to say to a sympathetic community in the Islamic world, look, we told you the United States is engaged in a war against Islam. They're picking on the Iraqis when many countries, even in Europe, do not buy it. That said, you also need to think of some possible benefits of this as well. The Saudis have announced that if all goes well with the war with Iraq, mm-hmm. the United States might leave the Arabian Peninsula.
And they might begin to democratize in however modest fashion.
Right, exactly. I mean, don't hold your breath on the Saudis,
yeah.
But this is one possibility. War, for better and usually for worse, creates great change. And the key is being prepared to take advantage of many of these changes. Mm-hmm.
Rohan Gunaratne, your bottom line, war on Iraq, does it help or hurt in the war on terrorism, your specialty?
It will certainly hurt, and it will make it more difficult for us to fight terrorism, because it will be difficult for the United States to sustain the support of the Arab and the Asian Muslim countries. If the United States goes to Iraq, especially, it goes without the UN mandate.
We have a lot of callers who want to join this conversation. Keith is calling from Milwaukee. Hi, Keith. You're on the air.
Hi, thanks.
Sure.
I think it's an extreme stretch for people to say that because of bin Laden's expressed support for the Iraqi people, that saying that he's somehow connected with Hussein. I mean, he flat out says that he has no high regard for Hussein, and therefore, how in the world the Bush administration, and I'm very, very disappointed in Colin Powell for saying this, that somehow because he supports this that he's connected with it. I mean, that's an extreme stretch. The thing that I find very ironic about this is that no serious intelligence agency has proven a link between al-Qaeda and the Hussein government.
But Keith, tonight we're hearing from our experts on the air that the convergence of interests may create a kind of twinned peril here, even if there has not been an active alliance. What do you make of that?
Isn't that ironic? I mean, what we're doing, in effect, by creating this invasion is we're making a self-fulfilling prophecy.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Ruhan Gunaratne, what about this notion of Colin Powell's credibility having been diminished by his characterization of alliance in bin Laden's statement? Do you see him as diminished on the credibility front?
I think he should be more careful, because traditionally Saddam has suppressed the Islamists, suppressed the Islamic movement of Kurdistan, which has now evolved into Al-Ansar al-Islami.
Mm-hmm.
So you can see that traditionally Osama has been opposed to leaders like Gaddafi, leaders like Saddam, who are secular leaders who have suppressed the Islamists. There is no such relationship. Of course, They hate the United States, irrespective of their differing and different ideologies.
May I add one thing
here? Dan Byman, please.
Saddam has a history, however, of working with groups that at times despise him. In the early 1980s, late 1970s, for example, his government supported Islamists in Syria. And it wasn't because they had any sympathy for the Islamist cause. It was because these people were against a shared enemy, Hafez al-Assad. And this is exactly the sort of relationship that may have been forged after 9/11, maybe being forged today, which is tactical cooperation, not out of a mutual love, but out of mutual hatred of a third country, in this case the United States.
So do you see, then, this statement as, in fact, the kind of justification for the Washington fears that have been voiced for months now, that whether they were actively engaged with one another or not, sooner or later Iraq and al-Qaeda would find their interests converging. Does this redeem those statements which have been widely doubted, or has the United States created this convergence?
There are two questions there. The first is, what we saw after September 11th and the last few months were a lot of statements initially doubted, now seeming to gain more and more specific evidence vouched for by intelligence services in other countries that there is some cooperation, not necessarily active sponsorship, but cooperation between Iraq and al-Qaeda. Not this statement, but things like training and poisons. However, clearly, the United States measure is driving these two together. It's forcing Saddam to be more concerned about his survival, which is making him take gambles that he wouldn't otherwise take. And traditionally, Iraq has been very cautious in its use of terrorism. And what the CIA said in an open letter was that an attack on Iraq may mean all bets are off, and that Saddam, simply for revenge or perhaps to ensure his own survival, may do things with terrorists he's never done before.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Jerry's calling from Meadville, Pennsylvania. Hi, Jerry. You're on the air.
Hi. I have a question. Would it be possible for al-Qaeda to link up with Hamas and Hezbollah and move, at the appropriate time, move a force of several thousand of their combatants into Baghdad, and then after the war is over, turn it into an urban war against the occupying United States and disrupt any possible effort of bringing the stability to that country, and then turn it, in effect, into a mini Vietnam War?
Jerry, that is a great question. Ruhan Gunaratne, I hope you heard that. The question is, I guess, let's assume there's a war, assume there's an American victory in the early stages. Would it be possible for al-Qaeda, Hamas, Hezbollah to move in and make it impossible for order to gel? Or is that far-fetched in your mind?
Al-Qaeda does not have the type of strength that is required to do that kind of operation. Al-Qaeda's strength was about 3,000 members when the United States went into Afghanistan, and this strength has reduced now to a few hundred supporters. Of course, they have a large number of they have a large number of supporters and sympathizers. So I believe that scenario will not work. And traditionally, the Palestinian groups have kept away from Al-Qaeda because they didn't want to be absorbed by Al-Qaeda. So we have not seen all that cooperation between the Palestinian groups and Al-Qaeda, although we have seen cooperation between the other Islamist groups and Al-Qaeda. Al-Qaeda does not work in such an open, overt way. It is more a clandestine, secret terrorist organization.
Rafad's calling from Boston. Hi, Rafad. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
My comment is, and I disagree 100% with the first comment of Mr. Rohan when he said that this tape of Osama could have an influence over the Muslim population. Actually, what shows that until now, unfortunately, there is misunderstanding, of the Muslim population over the world and their problem. The Muslim population is something that they don't need someone like Osama bin Laden or even Saddam. Even if Saddam carried the flag of religion and all this thing, they won't believe him, they won't trust him because he's already not a trustworthy man in the Islamic world. So the only reason the Muslim world are against this war is because they believe, as many of non-Muslim even all over the world, that this war is unjust and it's going to bring destruction and more death to the innocent Iraqi people.
Rafad, you raise a couple of interesting points there. We understand your view of the war itself, but Dan Byman, what about this notion, and I've wondered this myself, do we risk making Osama bin Laden loom larger than he is? Is he just surfing here on a body of Middle Eastern resentment of the war idea, but not really leading it, not really its orchestrator?
Certainly. He's already an extremely large figure, so inflating him in the Muslim world is a touch like inflating Michael Jordan's image among basketball fans.
Okay.
It can be done, but he's already pretty big. The only thing I would add is with a war in Iraq, particularly if it's a very quick, decisive war in favor of the United States and its allies, it will actually further legitimate bin Laden because it will show to people opposed to the United States that the most effective means of resistance is terrorism, that the conventional means that Iraq champions do not work. So ironically, a rapid conventional victory may cause problems in the long term as well.
Ooh, Rafad, thanks for your call. Jack Beattie, there's an image.
Yeah, it is indeed. I just want to return to what Jerry raised, that the possibility of terrorism against Americans, a kind of Vietnam in miniature situation.
In Iraq, post-attack.
In Iraq, yeah. He should look at a piece in Sunday's Los Angeles Times about what they call amateur terrorism, not terrorism necessarily connected to any of these groups, but on the one hand, but either religious terrorism from people in Iraq who are just affrighted by the notion of America occupying it, nationalist terrorism from people who feel that this is a kind of taking of their country, and that this is a real possibility.
Rohan Gunaratne in Singapore, Dan Byman in Washington, and Jack Beattie right here. Please stand by. We're going to take a short break. We're talking tonight about the new bin Laden message and what it means. You can join the conversation. Who is winning this chess game, Bush or bin Laden? Does bin Laden sound on the run to you? And who's winning hearts and minds in the Middle East? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the new bin Laden message and what it means for terror at home, war abroad, and the battle for hearts and minds in the Middle East. My guests are Rohan Gunaratne, author of Inside Al-Qaeda, Global Network of Terror, joining us tonight from Singapore. From Washington, Dan Byman, assistant professor of security studies at Georgetown University. Here in the studio, our own Jack Beattie. You're welcome to join us as well. Does bin Laden seem to welcome the looming war with Iraq? Is Washington playing into his hands? Who is winning this chess game, Bush or bin Laden? Does bin Laden sound on the run to you? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Charlie's calling from Jamaica Plain, Massachusetts. Hi, Charlie. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
Fine, thanks.
My comment, I actually have a son who's a Marine. He's in the Persian Gulf right now.
Okay.
So he's in the mix there.
High stakes in your household.
High stakes in my household. And the issue that I see, I don't remember it, but I remember hearing about Franklin Roosevelt saying that the only thing we have to fear is fear itself. It seems to me that George Bush has totally turned that on its head and said what we're going to do is use fear itself to get whatever policies put forward we want. That George Bush wants. And, you know, several months ago, I got something over the internet that somebody had put together that was a picture of Osama bin Laden saying, I want you to bomb Iraq. And it seems to me that this is just another phase in using the fear of Osama bin Laden to get the war policies George Bush wants in place.
Charlie, I have to ask, do you share this view, Father Charlie, with your Marine son in the Gulf? And if you do, what does he say back to you?
My son knows exactly how I feel about this rush to war, and I'm very careful not to speak for him. I only speak for myself.
Understood. Charlie, thanks for raising it. Let me put it to our guest, Rohan Gunaratna. I guess to you first, the issue of fear and how it's playing out here. There is incredible anxiety tonight in Washington and in London. Americans have been advised on the Department of Homeland Security website to buy duct tape and batteries and water and seal their windows in case of attack, chem-bio attack. How is fear being used here, in your view? Is it being used reasonably? Is it being used in a manipulating way? And if so, by whom?
Osama bin Laden is a leader who uses fear very, very effectively. You can see his messages after every attack and before every attack. And I think that the American people should not fall victim to Osama's plan. More than the physical impact of his attacks, it is the psychological and the political damage that he causes. And I think that it would be a mistake for the U.S. intelligence agencies to advise that this man poses such a big threat. In my opinion, Al-Qaeda cannot launch large-scale coordinated attacks of the scale of 9/11 again because its strength has depleted to a few hundred members. Although it is still a very dynamic and a very powerful organization, its strength has been significantly reduced.
So what is your assessment then, Rohan Gunaratna, of how the Bush administration is managing the fear lever here with the American people? Is it conveying an appropriate sense of concern? Is it manipulating or using fear?
I think it is using fear. I think what the Bush administration should do is to focus on the on fighting the Al-Qaeda organization, destroy the core and the penultimate leadership of Al-Qaeda. As long as Osama, Dr. Ayman Zawahiri, his deputy leader and designated successor, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, the mastermind of 9/11 operation, are alive, Al-Qaeda will continue to pose a threat. And it is important to get rid of the terrorist threat and then to focus on other campaigns.
Andrew's calling from Whitewater, Wisconsin. Hi, Andrew. You're on the air.
Good evening, gentlemen.
Good evening. Hi.
Got to be honest, I'm a little bit afraid, but I'm very frustrated. I feel that our foreign policy is aiding and driving these two disparate forces together. We are part of the reason that now there's a possible link between Iraq and Al-Qaeda. And we're also, our foreign policy, our cowboy mentality, the axis of evil, is creating pockets in the world of anti-American sentiment, which is exactly the kind of environment that a terrorist network can thrive in. And I'm very frustrated by that. I feel that we are actually our own worst enemy in this war.
Andrew, we hear it in your voice, and I understand you're not the first person I've heard say that. But Dan Byman, do you see this as a credible frustration, as a credible line of critique, or is Washington doing the best it can?
It's certainly a credible line of critique. The counterargument would be that two of the main reasons for going to war with Iraq have very little to do with terrorism. One is weapons of mass destruction in of themselves, and the other is a broader humanitarian concern. Now, I don't claim that the Bush administration holds those two equally, but they're trying to throw out multiple arguments. And, of course, without any complex and major policy decision like war, it has trade-offs. But one concern people have had again and again is turning the world against the United States needlessly. This can be small things as well, very restrictive visa procedures for people who regularly go in and out of the United States from the Muslim world, who are often America's best allies and champions in their community.
Mm-hmm.
These are people who we want to go to their countries and say the United States is a land of tolerance. But instead, when they're harassed here, it creates the opposite impression.
Jack Beatty, what about Andrew's concern?
Just take a look at what's happening to our alliances. We have precipitated through this rush to war the worst client, the worst crisis in the North American alliance, in the North Atlantic alliance since its inception. And we have our people talking about maybe this is the end of NATO. If a year ago you could say that a war in Iraq was going to cost us our NATO alliance or even severely weaken it, people would say, oh, that's ridiculous. That's basic. Meanwhile, in the other part of the world, our diplomacy with North Korea, our standoff with them, our refusal to talk to them directly, is weakening our ties to South Korea.
Another long-time rock-solid ally.
Oh, so here we are. This drive for Iraq is costing us with our traditional allies in Europe, and we're ignoring the situation because we're so focused in Korea. We're so focused on Iraq that we're ignoring that, and that's costing us in South Korea.
And yet there sits that threat in Iraq. Even the inspectors don't deny it. John's calling from Eagle River, Wisconsin. Hi, John. You're on the air.
Hi, how are you?
Fine.
I actually play chess 2 or 3 hours a night on the Internet, and Osama's winning this game hands down. He's playing better than Kasparov ever played.
What's the evidence?
Well, in fact, for Powell to say that announcement on Al Jazeera is a connection, it's no connection at all. I mean, it says no connection at all. And I wouldn't put it past the Bush administration to create the tape themselves just to get us into this. They want to get us into this. I don't get it.
So you see an administration that you fear is capable even of creating the tape itself. John, thanks for your call. Rohan Gunaratne, do you have any doubt about the legitimacy of the tape?
Certainly the tape was not created by the Bush administration or the CIA. It is Osama's message. It is Osama's voice. It is his syntax. It is his intonations. And it is the way he changes his way of approaching, espousing the Palestinian issue, now espousing the Iraq issue, just to maintain and to rebuild the Muslim popular support. And I think the United States must be cautious of going into Iraq because he is still alive. As long as the core and the penultimate leadership of that group is alive, the United States must not go into Iraq, especially without a UN mandate, because that means the US will lose significant popular support, will lose its allies and its friends. It must be cautious.
Dan Byman, you hear Rohan Gunaratne, a leading authority on al-Qaeda, saying do not go into Iraq before you've taken care of this al-Qaeda leadership. But you must sense, sitting in Washington, that that is not the sequence that the Bush administration has in mind.
Certainly not. I mean, there certainly seems a very strong commitment to having gone almost all the way down the road to war to going the next few steps. One question I would have with respect for Dr. Gunaratne's assertion is, if the United States backed down now, and particularly now after the release of the bin Laden audio tape, would it create the impression that the United States has caved to bin Laden? He would certainly claim that.
A victory for Saddam and bin Laden. But can is it a mistake to be held hostage by that kind of thing? I mean, Vietnam left a bad taste about, you know, hanging in because honor demanded it.
Certainly you should not go to war slowly because you don't want to be embarrassed to back down. But if you believe that the strategic rationale is sound, I think that very few people in the United States, at least, have questioned the weapons of mass destruction aspect of it. The focus has been on more doubts about terrorism. If you believe the strategic rationale is strong, backing down solely because of fears of a strike today, I think, is wrong, because that fear will exist in 6 months or 12 months or 2 years unless you get lucky and get bin Laden himself.
Rohan Gunaratne, we just have a few seconds left. The pattern with bin Laden, an attack after a message. Is that the historical pattern? Do you expect some kind of attack to follow this message?
Certainly he will want to conduct an attack, although it will be difficult for him to do a large-scale attack. But just to show his support to the Iraqi people, he will certainly order his people to conduct at least a symbolic attack, if not inside the United States, against a U.S. target overseas.
Rohan Gunaratne, thank you for joining us tonight.
Thank you.
Rohan Gunaratne is author of Inside Al-Qaeda, Global Network of Terror, and Dan Byman in Washington. Thank you so much for being with us.
My pleasure.
Dan Byman is Associate Professor of Security Studies at Georgetown University and the co-author of The Dynamics of Coercion, American Foreign Policy, and the Limits of Military Might. Jack Beatty, this is not a pretty picture.
No, it's not. I just want to express my sympathy and solidarity with Charlie, our caller with a Marine son there who's doing his duty, and Charlie having to hold his bite his lip when he communicates his doubts about his war to his son. I'm proud of his son, and I'm sympathetic to his dilemma.
A father with many allegiances. Jack, thanks for being with us tonight. Listeners, you can continue this conversation online at onpointradio.org. Click on forums. This is On Point. They're not quite as renowned as the Navy SEALs, but a group of genuine sea lions is playing a key role for the U.S. military in the Persian Gulf. The 350-pound marine mammals have been drafted to detect intruders and mines around aircraft carriers. Their keen sense of hearing and ability to swim up to 25 miles an hour could make them perfect watchdogs for American warships. And that is what the Navy is currently testing in the Gulf. Mark Thompson is national security correspondent for Time magazine. He says the Navy's reliance on creatures of the sea is nothing new.
Well, the Navy's been using marine mammals going back to like 1960 when they first took a dolphin because they thought this dolphin goes so fast, maybe we can learn something about designing torpedoes from it. They didn't learn anything about designing torpedoes in that first experiment, but subsequently, because of dolphins' sonar ability and sea lions' acute sense of hearing, the Navy has come to realize that both of these underwater mammals can do a very fine job at detecting things underwater that could threaten U.S. warships. Protecting a big 1,000-foot-long ship at night is very difficult work. You can do some of it with sonar. You can do some of it with lookouts on the deck, looking for bubbles or other signs of enemy fragment, perhaps approaching a vessel. I think really the sea lions have been sent to the Persian Gulf not as a one-size-fits-all answer, but as a slice of a pizza of ways of dealing with the problem. The way they intend on employing the sea lions is they go out in a little rubber boat with two or three humans, each of them does. The rather portly sea lion, you know, bails out of the little boat. They weigh about 400 pounds, 350 pounds on average, these on this mission. Then they have a very acute sense of hearing that can pick up the subtle sounds, for example, of a frogman or of water rippling across a floating mine. And then they can either go back to their human handlers and say, there's something over there, boss, that you might be interested in. Or in the event of an enemy frogman, they actually have a couple of capturing devices that they can clamp onto a bad guy, bring a rope or a line to the surface, and have the humans grab hold of that and haul in their catch and see what they've found. The Navy says that in their 30 years of dolphin experiments, when they let, and they do let, the animals out in the open sea, only 7 have failed to return. So plainly, most of them, if they don't enjoy the work, at least they don't find it too arduous. We needn't mix up James Bond here. These sea lions and dolphins aren't on the cutting edge of warfare. I think it's much more realistic to think of them as being like the military working dogs that the military uses to guard bases, to check for drugs or for bombs. They have a very circumscribed role. It's not damaging to the mammals. And if it works, you know, better than either machinery, humans, or another varmint can do, why not? That seems to be the Navy's attitude here.
Mark Thompson is national security correspondent for Time magazine. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.